This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick, and here is what's coming up.
In the most recent incident in a refugee camp in the east of the country, on June 24, four refugee children aged from 9 to 12 were killed, and three others were seriously injured when they picked up an unexploded device and tried to open it.
That's UNHCR spokesman Babar Balogh on the growing threat of landmines and unexploded ordnance to refugees in the conflict-wracked Sahel region. The story and more are next on Africa News Tonight. We begin in Mali, where hopes for a quick resolution of the West African country's political crisis seem to have vanished. Despite recommendations from a regional summit early this week, the opposition stands firm in its call for the president's resignation and has vowed that protests will also resume soon. Nicolas Pinon reports from Paris.
The only watchword remains the resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta. That short statement came last night during a news conference by the opposition spokesperson, who added a second phase of civil disobedience will occur 3 days after the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. Imam Mahmoud Diko, the religious leader who has been leading the demonstrations, also told reporters he has asked Prime Minister Boubou Cissé to step down. This is a dead end in the political crisis besides the recommendations that the 15-nation regional bloc ECOWAS made Monday. West African leaders had suggested forming a new unity government and threatened to sanction those who oppose urbanization in Mali. The Malian nation must be restored by Malians for Malians, Diko said yesterday. At least 11 people died in clashes with security forces over the past few weeks in Mali. Earlier this week, the UN Security Council expressed deep concern over the situation in the country. Nicolas Pinol for VOA News, Paris.
The UN Refugee Agency is calling for urgent action to stop the killing and maiming of refugees and other forcibly displaced people from landmines and improvised explosive devices in Africa's Sahel and Lake Chad basin regions. Lisa Schlein reports for us from Geneva.
Deaths and injuries from these indiscriminate killing machines are rising at an alarming rate. Security forces reportedly are the intended targets of attacks by various armed groups operating in Africa's conflict-ridden Sahel and Lake Chad Basin. But the UN Refugee Agency says civilians are paying the heaviest price. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloch says landmines and unexploded ordnance are posing a growing threat to refugees, internally displaced people, and the local communities hosting them. He says many of the victims are children under age 18.
Chad and Nigeria top the most affected countries in the Lake Chad Basin. In the most recent incident in a refugee camp in the east of the country, on June 24, four refugee children aged from 9 to 12 were killed, and three others were seriously injured when they picked up an unexploded device and tried to open it.
Balogh says hundreds of deaths and injuries from landmines and improvised explosive devices have been reported in northeastern Nigeria. He says UNHCR teams on the ground have witnessed a rising trend in the Sahel in the killing and maiming of civilians from these lethal weapons. The Sahel is facing one of the fastest-growing displacement crises in the world. Balogh notes millions of people have fled indiscriminate attacks and widespread violations from armed groups, including summary executions and rape.
In addition to the high death toll, injuries and their after effects, including psychological damages, the presence of explosive devices hinder access to local livelihoods such as pastures, fields, farms, firewood collection, as well as community infrastructure. They also affect delivery of humanitarian aid and development activities.
The UNHCR is calling on governments and humanitarian organizations to speed up the removal of these dangerous weapons. It says awareness campaigns must be expanded to inform populations at risk about the horrifying threats they face and what they can do to protect themselves from these barbaric weapons of war. The Landmine and Cluster Munitions Monitor reports more than 120,000 civilian deaths and injuries have been documented since the landmine ban came into force in 1999. It reports casualties continue to rise despite the ban. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
While the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says more than 5 million people in war-torn Somalia are in need of humanitarian assistance, including over 3 million children, due to the combined devastating impact of floods, the locust invasion, and the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Kiama reports.
UNICEF officials say the situation in the war-torn Horn of African nation is worsening due to decades of conflict, cyclical drought, and floods. Sarah Kerimboy is the chief of emergencies at UNICEF Somalia.
At this moment, 5.2 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance, of which 3 million are children. The flooding at this moment has already displaced about 400,000 people. And the locusts are on their fourth cycle of eating the harvest, basically, massively affecting the food security situation.
Heavy rainfall has affected wide areas in Somalia since April, triggering flash floods and displacing tens of thousands of people. In recent months, there has been a surge in cases of acute watery diarrhea and cholera in parts of the country. But the UNICEF official says children are often the hidden victims of any emergency and are more susceptible to waterborne diseases as a result of flooding and severe malnutrition due to food shortages.
The floods are causing acute watery diarrhea and cholera in areas that have never had it before. At this moment, the linkage between that is that as you see increases in acute watery diarrhea, you are also seeing increases in severe malnutrition. We have, in terms of severely malnourished children, we are already at 82% of our projected caseload for 2020, and we are only in July.
Jesper Mola, the deputy representative of UNICEF Somalia, said the existing problem of malnutrition among children was further worsening the situation. And the effect of locust invasion and the COVID-19 pandemic means the international community has to act fast to help millions of Somali families and especially the children. While the immediate impact of the locust invasion is on crop production, which is projected to be 10 to 15% lower than the long-term average, Mola says the secondary impact likely will be an increase of children being severely malnourished due to food shortages. Whereas the donor community has remained responsive in tackling the global COVID-19 pandemic, Kerimhoy says little help has been coming to address other crises.
To date, UNICEF Somalia has 60% of its COVID appeal funded, but we do have an overall appeal for Somalia, which is at $129 million, and of that, we have only received funding for $30 million. And this is quite concerning because the impact of the three together, the triple threat, will strain all of our resources.
In response to the triple threat, UNICEF, in close coordination with the Somali government and local partners, is working to not only prevent and mitigate the spread of COVID-19, but to continue providing life-saving assistance to those desperately in need. As part of those efforts, nearly 1 million vulnerable people have received critical hygiene items, including access to safe water. More than 500,000 women and children have been given basic health and nutritional services in flooded communities and camps for the internally displaced. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Meanwhile, the International Rescue Committee says its COVID-19 response across African countries is, quote, fighting the epidemic in the dark, and that cases of the coronavirus are much higher than official numbers suggest. The IRC says a lack of data due to testing capacity, poor health infrastructure, and stigma is hampering its ability to plan and execute an effective COVID response. Confirmed cases have risen by 500% in Africa in the past 2 months. The IRC says testing shortfalls make it nearly impossible to understand the extent of the pandemic. It's calling for more funding and international support to stop the spread of the virus. More than 1 million livestock being transported from Cameroon and Chad for Eid al-Adha, the Muslim feast of sacrifice, have been blocked at the borders with Equatorial Guinea, Gabon and Nigeria. Cameroon's neighboring states are refusing imports due to COVID-19, forcing livestock merchants who depend on the annual festival, known locally as Tabaski, to sell at cut-rate prices. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Spokesperson for the Central African Association of Cattle Sellers, Clementina Ondo, says that trade was already crumbling because of COVID-19. The situation is made worse, she says, because border authorities are blocking trade of their livestock raised to sell for the Muslim feast of Eid al-Adha, known locally as Tabaski. Ondo spoke via a messaging application from the Cameroon town of Kiosi on the borders with Equatorial Guinea and Gabon.
Kiosi ravitaille le Gabon. Kiosi ravitaille la Guinée équatoriale.
She says at least 500 sheep and cattle sellers now find themselves in serious economic hardship. Ondo says it is unfair for major consumers of their animals like Gabon and Equatorial Guinea to completely seal their borders during peak sales period, like the Feast of Tabaski. She says Cameroon refused entry to 20 trucks sent from Equatorial Guinea and Gabon to transport sheep in less than 24 hours. Ondo says the sheep and cattle were from northern Cameroon and Chad, where ranching is a main economic activity. Cameroon's Prime Minister Joseph John Goute on Wednesday denied his country is blocking the livestock trade.
We require a certificate to show that people coming in are free from the virus, so the frontiers are not closed. They are still open, but to certain categories of transporters.
In March, Cameroon and its neighbors, the Central African Republic, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, and Nigeria, sealed their borders to stop the spread of COVID-19. Cameroon and Chad later said they would allow merchants access as they were suffering economic hardship from the pandemic. Livestock traders had hoped neighboring states would follow suit or were unaware of the restrictions. But the Association of Cattle Sellers this week reported that Equatorial Guinea and Gabon refused imports of over 200,000 sheep and cattle. The association says Nigerian border authorities blocked another 500,000 animals from being exported from Cameroon. But while Cameroon's livestock suppliers are suffering the glut, local buyers are benefiting. 28-year-old Cameroonian butcher Kaigama Abo says prices have dropped by up to 70%. He says he can now afford to buy many sheep for the Tabaski feast with Muslim neighbors and friends, and also to store for selling when price goes up. Abo says he is buying as many sheep as possible to sell and make much profit when COVID-19 reduces and the borders are opened. He says sheep he buys today at between $60 and $100 are normally sold for $400 to $500. Abo says he cannot miss the opportunity. But while Cameroon's Muslims are celebrating the low prices, the Tabaski feast will still be hampered by pandemic restrictions. People are required to gather in groups of 50 or less, wear face masks, frequently wash their hands, and keep a distance of at least 2 meters from each other. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. Hopes of a resolution to Mali's political crisis seem to have vanished as the opposition stands firm in its call for the president to step down and vows to resume protests. The UN is raising the alarm about the growing threat of landmines and unexploded ordnance to refugees in the Sahel region. And Zimbabwe's government has signed a deal to compensate white farmers displaced during its controversial land redistribution program 2 decades ago. Thank you for listening to VOA Africa. For more news and information, do visit our website at voanews.com. The United Nations World Food Programme is appealing for an additional $250 million in emergency aid to help millions of Zimbabweans at risk of hunger. The WFP says the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening an already severe hunger crisis in the southern African nation. WFP says that by year's end, the number of food insecure Zimbabweans is expected to hit 8.6 million, 60% of the population, due to the combined effects of drought, economic recession, and the pandemic. Increasingly desperate families are eating less, selling off precious belongings, and going into debt. A lawyer for an alleged Rwandan ex-spy chief living in France says his client denies allegations that he was involved in Rwanda's 1994 genocide. Lisa Bryant has more on Alois Ntiwiragabo, now under investigation by French prosecutors.
In an interview with VOA, lawyer Benjamin Shue says his client, Alois Ntiwiragabo, has been living in France for years. One of two lawyers defending Ntiwiragabo, Shue said French authorities have been fully aware of his client's whereabouts since Ntiwiragabo applied for legal status here. French judicial authorities said Saturday they had opened a crimes against humanity probe targeting Ntiwiragabo. The move followed a report by investigative news site Mediapart, which tracked the former intelligence chief and his wife to a suburb of Orléans, about 110 kilometers south of Paris. The former International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, or ICTR, once identified Ntiwiragabo as one of the architects of the Rwandan genocide that killed about 800,000 people. But the AFP news agency reports the ICTR, now succeeded by another mechanism, had long ago dropped an arrest warrant against Ntiwiragabo, as did French and Rwandan authorities. Reports suggest investigators seem to have lost track of him years ago. Lawyer Shue says his client was not in hiding. He says Ntiwiragabo never hid his real identity in France and is available now to answer investigators' questions. His client strongly contests the Mediapart report, Shue says, and insists he played no role in the genocide. Radio France International reports Ntiwiragabo remained in Rwanda's military during the genocide, but at least initially cited against a key organizer of the killings. Ntiwiragabo also authored a 2018 book offering his version of the broader 1990s Great Lakes conflict through French publishing house Edition Scribe. The French probe into his actions follows the May arrest in France of another major genocide suspect. Félicien Kabuga is accused of bankrolling the genocide. The 84-year-old had been hiding for years outside Paris and is now appealing his transfer to Arusha, Tanzania, to face trial.
Nous, nous avons déposé plus d'une trentaine de plaintes. Quand on me pose la question,
Alain Gauthier, who heads a French genocide survivors group, estimates several dozen other suspects remain at large in France. He denounces the slowness of France's judicial system. Other alleged suspects include Agathe Habyarimana, widow of the former Rwandan president whose death helped trigger the genocide. She lives outside of Paris. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The South African government says the COVID-19 storm, as it calls it, is now hitting the country. Most urban areas are reporting surges in infections, with health facilities and field hospitals struggling with the burden of sick and critically ill people. Darren Taylor reports in the finale of a three-part series on a South African family's experience of trying to survive COVID-19.
Fazila Abrahams' 61-year-old sister Yasmin Hafiji is in an intensive care unit, or ICU, at a private hospital in Cape Town. Her 59-year-old brother-in-law, Shiraz, was also there until he recently became yet another South African whose life has been claimed by the coronavirus. Abram says doctors did not record the couple's medical histories when they were admitted with COVID-19 6 weeks ago.
So doctors started treating them without knowing the history. And I was dying to get to this doctor to say, she's an asthmatic, he's a diabetic, she's had colon cancer, she's had chemotherapy 7 years ago, he had a ruptured colon. They needed this information to manage them.
Doctors and nurses say they're under such physical and mental strain that they're making mistakes. The government says South Africa simply doesn't have enough hospital beds and staff to handle the flood of patients. It maintains it used a three-month hard lockdown to get hospitals and healthcare workers ready for all the COVID-19 cases. Abrams, herself a medical researcher, says based on her experience, the state and private sector facilities failed to achieve this goal.
In the ICU, people obviously are not well trained. They didn't use that bloody 3 months that we have to prepare our nurses to take care.
A very tight-fitting mask called a CPAP helps people with COVID-19 to breathe. Doctors say the apparatus works better when patients lie on their bellies.
She lied on her stomach for 2 nights, extreme discomfort, but she said, I am doing this to get out of this ICU.
But while Hafiji got better, her husband got worse.
The reason he couldn't cope is this man had 2 operations on his stomach, and somebody had to tell them he can't lie in his stomach because he's got a massive hernia there still. They didn't recognize that.
Because of this, Abraham says her brother-in-law's symptoms intensified up until his death.
So imagine this is happening in a private hospital. Maybe it's not happening in our public hospitals. I hope not.
Abraham says for her, the COVID-19 experience has exploded the myth that South Africa's private healthcare resources are so much better than those in the public sector.
What worries me is that the private sector doctors are not as connected as the public sector doctors. Public sector, there's a team, there's ward rounds, and I think in the Western Cape...
State doctors have regular meetings to help one another to strategize against coronavirus by sharing information about patients. But in South Africa, private sector physicians essentially operate individual businesses and don't work as closely with colleagues. This, says Abrams, has fractured the private sector's response to the crisis.
Is there another Mr. Hendricks with similar symptoms in another ICU? What are we learning from that?
Abrams says her sister blames herself for Shiraz's death.
She's got huge guilt feelings about her husband because we believe she was ill first. That is traumatic at the moment.
Growing numbers of South Africans now have very personal stories to tell about how COVID-19 has affected them. It's only now, says the health minister, that the country is realizing the gravity of this pandemic. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Hayley Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, do visit our website at voanews.com. Thank you for tuning in, and as always, thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.